morning, Byers versus Lemon, case number 091833. Mr. Friedman?
Yes. Still morning. Good morning. May it please the court. Petitioner Byers was convicted of two murders after a two-day jury trial. At this two-day jury trial, there were two circumstances that were involved in the trial that didn't involve the guilt or his innocence. That were inherently prejudicial. There was the wearing of ankle restraints and ultimately the outburst by spectators that were victims' families. Holbrook versus Flynn makes it clear that the petitioner just has to show that there's an unacceptable risk of presence of impermissible factors coming into play. We submit there were actually two in this case, the restraints and ultimately the outburst by the spectators. These claims come through the vehicle of ineffectiveness because trial counsel didn't object to them to protect his interest. And therefore, we have to show a reasonable probability that he didn't receive a fair trial. At the minimum, that there was a chance of acquittal was better than negligible.
As a practical matter, how do you, 13 years after a trial, have an evidentiary hearing to see if there had any effect on the jurors, this outburst and the shackles?
Well, you look to see whether, as a matter, of course, as a practicality, they would. You don't have to show the state of mind of the jurors.
Would you anticipate that you would have to subpoena jurors and bring them in to testify to what they saw, what they heard?
Well, that's one way to do it. You also can have other people say that they saw it. You can also do it by circumstantial evidence. Have a drawing or a picture of the courtroom to show that the restraints were visible. That type of circumstantial evidence was ultimately done in Rocheri versus Anders in the Seventh Circuit case, where there were no jurors testifying and said we saw them restrained. I mean, it's different than perhaps the recent case of Wrinkles, where they said no, we didn't. But the state of the mind of the jurors are not in play here. At all, and that's
and in fact, you cannot inquire into the state of mind of the jurors.
Well, you could, but it's not required. I think you can for the purpose of the misconduct during the courtroom. We're not trying to impeach the verdict here.
The misconduct, as I understand it, that's referred to in the exception to the evidentiary bar of examining jurors as to their deliberations has to do with extraneous information reaching them. During deliberations, in other words, something that happens outside of the courtroom.
Right.
And what we've got here is stuff that's happening inside the
courtroom. We're only questioning, they would be only used to a question as to what they observed, not to their state of their mind as to the verdict. I know. And I
argue from inference from that.
Yes. It's like we ultimately supplemented the record with one affidavit from the juror said that she was frightened by one of the outbursts. I acknowledge that there's a lot of procedural issues in this case. They have interesting twists and turns, but I think the key issue here is prejudice, and whether the petitioner Byers did not receive a fair trial based on the fact that he was restrained and the outburst.
You're not going to address the procedural default?
Well, I have limited. I'm glad that I. We're willing to. I would at the end. I mean, I'm trying to live it out. What's the most important part of this case?
Right.
If the court wants me to talk about that, I will.
Well, what's your best three sentence argument against procedural default?
Okay, I'll go. The procedural default problem as to the restraints are inappropriate here. I mean, the case law is legion. It's an unusual factual pattern. The client was allowed to file a post-conviction petition to raise that issue. He requested it, and the court allowed it so that it could be reserved for federal court. Ultimately, the trial counsel in post-conviction didn't think it was a good issue, but nevertheless wrote it in his Anders brief, and that's a basis to preserve it. We also ultimately take the position that the client wrote letters to the court and the client, and they're attached in the appendix, which indicates that he was instructing his client the lawyer, the client was instructing the lawyer what to argue, and he refused to do that. I mean, I concede that the Coleman v. Thompson pretty much takes the shuts the door that you can't have ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. But, I mean, and that's because the obligation in post-conviction goes to the petitioner, not the lawyer. But frankly, he did everything he possibly could to try to preserve this issue other than go to law school, take a class in post-conviction, and pass the bar. I mean, this record is quite an effort of the client trying to preserve this issue. So that's the position, and that's at the minimum, to follow through on that. And I think that at the minimum we should be entitled to a hearing on the restraints. As to the issue of prejudice, we think that there is prejudice. This case was not overwhelming. There was no scientific evidence. There was no fingerprints, even though the sole eyewitness individual indicated that the alleged killer touched a lot of items and didn't have any gloves. Also, her testimony was highly inconsistent, and it was inconsistent by her description of the assailant. She said that he had crooked teeth, he had a scar, and that didn't fit the bill of the client, even of the petitioner here.
I thought she knew him.
That's exactly right. And if she knew him, she should be able to describe him. If somebody knew me and they said I was 6'2 and blonde, blue eyes, they wouldn't know me. And these are major descriptions. And I
take it you weren't the trial attorney in this case.
No, I wasn't. There's also another important point, and I think there's a reasonable inference here, that there was a criminal enterprise going on. The dispute came over whether there was money in the couch. And we know from the co-defendant's opinion that there was $5,000 in this couch. And if there's a criminal enterprise going on, she had a motive not to tell the truth. Maybe she was involved in it. Maybe she's protecting somebody else. Maybe she at the time was protecting the individual who did have crooked teeth and had a scar on his face. I mean, so what we're talking about here.
What was the defense in this case?
The defense in this case was that she was mistaken. I mean, that's what the closing argument.
That she had a motive to be mistaken?
That she was simply mistaken, to be perfectly blunt. I mean, reading the
wasn't a frame-up defense.
No. But I think we could have been looking at this and determining whether there was a fair trial or not. And also the petitioner had an alibi. So when you compare his testimony versus his alibi, I mean, I think there's more than a negligible chance. I mean, there's a two-day trial where he's restrained, and there's outbursts going on.
What do we know about the restraints? We don't know very much.
We know that the judge saw it when he went up.
Well, he saw something.
Yeah, he asked what it was, and he saw something, and then that's enough. I submit that's enough.
I take it that when he was seated at counsel table, there was some kind of a barrier or a skirt around the table or something?
There's no indication of that. There's no indication of that or any justification for him being restrained. Unless this court has any questions, I'll save a minute and a half for rebuttal.
Thank you. Ms. Miklos.
May it please the court. This court should hold Byers to his decisions in the state court and in determining both that he procedurally defaulted his IAC restraint claim and also any attempt of his to expand the record. And I would start with the procedural default, if that's okay. Byers elected to proceed with counsel despite knowing his options and knowing that his counsel was not presenting his IAC restraint claim to the court.
This is basically an ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel.
He did raise an ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel in his pro se appellate brief on appeal from the denial of post-conviction relief. saying, in fact, that his post-conviction counsel did not raise his IAC restraint claim.
Right, and that's how we're sort of getting in the back door of all of this, as I understand it, procedurally.
That is one way that they are trying to say that he is not in default. And, in fact, Boyko and Lewis v. Sturms both address that when you raise an IAC claim on an issue, the issue itself is not preserved. That is, you're procedurally defaulted on that issue if you then intend to raise that in federal court, because you've raised it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And that's what he did on appeal. So not only did he not present it to the post-conviction court, he did not present it to the Indiana Court of Appeals on appeal from the denial of post-conviction relief, because he framed it in a ineffective assistance of post-conviction relief. Sorry, post-conviction counsel. And that is how the Indiana Court of Appeals addressed the issue that he raised, exactly how he raised it. Now on habeas, he's claiming that, in fact, it was presented to the post-conviction court. And I think Byers, the way that he presented, didn't present, was back and forth, equivocal about how he wanted to proceed with counsel, without counsel, which he ultimately decided to proceed with counsel, shows the wisdom in the Indiana law, in the trial court, asking Byers to go only through his attorney. He hired an attorney, and the court was clear that he was only going to look at the claims that his attorney raised. He gave Byers' attorney plenty of time to look at the claims that Byers wanted to present, and in fact, the trial court allowed Byers to present as an exhibit, which I believe is Exhibit D in the record, a list of the claims that Byers wanted his attorney to look at. And the agreement in the courtroom between the two parties is that that list was not presenting those claims to the court. It was rather just making a record of what Byers wanted to present and what his attorney was going to look at and what his attorney was going to come back to the post-conviction court and tell him what the claims ultimately were, which his attorney came back and said, I'm not presenting the claims that Byers wants me to raise. I'm proceeding on the other claims, and no further evidentiary hearing is needed on those claims. And, in fact, the attorney was not obligated to raise the claims that Byers urged him to raise. And any discretionary procedural rule, it allows flexibility for the court to excuse a procedural default, but here the court was clear. I'm only going to look at the claims your attorney tells me you're going to raise. And in that way, he's procedurally defaulted his IAC claim. In any event, that claim is not meritorious. There is no evidence to show that Byers was wearing readily visible leg restraints during his two-day trial. And in fact, the evidence showing his guilt is very strong. We have Amika Dodds, who he was convicted of two counts of murder, but he was also convicted of attempted murder of Almika Dodds. She knew him, knew the guy that he was with when they came into the house, and then she was face-to-face with them, and in fact, they tried to kill her. So this is somebody that she knew. She knew Byers' girlfriend. She told the police, you have a picture of him. He was arrested the night of the Tyson Holyfield fight, and so you should have a picture of him in his files. And lo and behold, the police go, and they find his mugshot, and they show it to her in a photo array, and she identified that particular photo as being Byers.
Usually when a defendant appears in a jury trial in restraints, there's a great deal of effort made to make a record about the need for those restraints, and then there is also an effort to shield the restraints from the view of the jury. And was there any such record made in this case?
The record is silent on that. There's no evidence from the direct appeal record that there was any kind of discussion, anything at all.
Is there a reference in the trial record to him being in restraints in the courtroom?
The only reference is when Byers' counsel wanted him to show his face to the jury so that they could look at it. So there was a dress rehearsal without the jury in the courtroom where they were going to show Byers where to walk and where to stand and to return to the table. And as they were doing it, the judge said, "What is that anklet thing? Oh, it's not so bad." That's the only reference to anything in the state court that could resemble that he had some sort of leg restraint. That's it.
So we don't even know what it was for?
No, we don't know what it was for. We don't know if it was seen by the jury. We don't know what it is, the nature of it. We don't know if there were efforts such as in Roche, as my opposing counsel mentioned, that there's a cover for leg shackles. There's no mention of that.
Is it even described as a restraint or a leg shackle?
It's anklet thing is what the trial court said. There's no description of the arrangement of the courtroom, whether there was a barrier between Byers and the jury. And in fact, the whole purpose of Byers showing himself to the jury was to show his head and to show his teeth and to show his face. It wasn't to show his ankles. That wasn't the focus. So there's no indication from the record that he was wearing readily visible leg shackles during the trial.
So this isn't really a restraint case at all?
Well,
because there was no record made that what he was wearing was a restraint.
Now, on post-conviction, Byers speaks to the post-conviction court about what claims he wants to raise. And he uses the words, I'm sure I will be corrected if I misquote him, that he had restraints and he was made to walk before the jury. Now, if we consider that to be some sort of testimony by him, evidence admitted, he was never cross. There wasn't any questioning of Byers that I remember. That is also, I believe, where Byers' counsel is using to bolster their restraints claim.
But that's when his. I mean, I've been viewing this case as an ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim. And the post-conviction counsel made a record that claim was not meritorious.
And that's true, and it is not exactly an IAC PCR, and I'm sorry, it's tongue twisters, claim. However, that has been asserted by Byers' counsel to excuse the procedural default and also to expand the record.
Bootstrap the merits claim.
And the bootstrap, yes, because that is what he raised on appeal.
Right.
And so they're saying that because that's the basis of his ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, that sufficiently preserved for federal habeas review the basis as its own freestanding claim, the IAC restraint claim. That's correct. So there are several layers, but any way you look at it, he never fully and fairly presented that claim to either the post-conviction court or the Indiana Court of Appeals. Now, he did raise it as a freestanding claim in his petition to transfer to the Indiana Supreme Court, but that is not allowed. You cannot come back in a later appellate brief where you never presented it to the courts below. So
I'm clear now.
Okay. Did I answer your question? The second claim quickly is the outburst claim, which there is no, we agree that this was properly preserved for federal review. But again, just as his restraints claim suffers from a lack of any evidence, so does his outburst claim. The only outburst on the record was by a Mrs. Dunlap. The police decided to arrest her son in the gallery during the trial, and she didn't like it, and she created a disruption. The court stopped the trial, called her up, asked her what she was doing, and I see that my light is on.
You can finish your summary.
Okay. And in any event, he held her in contempt, called the jury back in, apologized to the jury, and later in the transcript, he asked the jury if there's anything that they wanted to bring to his attention. This is on page, I believe, 810 of the trial record. And he said, is there any reason why you cannot be fair or impartial in this case? And no juror said a word. And I think that goes to both the IAC and whether there should have been a mistrial and whether his trial counsel acted appropriately. If there are no further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Friedman? You have a minute and a half.
Just briefly, the briefs extensively brief the post-conviction issue, and we submit almost every circuit supports the position that his shackling claim was not procedurally defaulted, allowing it through supplemental pleadings allowed by the court and by the Andrews pleadings. And I'd also indicate that shackling was prohibited in Indiana since 85, and there was no judge ruling on it at all because the judge didn't even know that he was shackled. He said, what is this thing? So this is all inappropriate. And I would submit that, it's, you know, today we argued in a very calm and serene courtroom, but his two-day trial was not serene and calm. He was restrained, and there were outbursts saying he should fry, he's not entitled to a trial, and we know that through his testimony and the prosecutors and the defense counsel knowledge that there were disturbances going on. And that two-day trial shouldn't stand.
All right. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Friedman, were you court appointed?
No, I was not.
All right. Thank you. Well, we thank both counsel. The case is taken under